What?
What? So yes, this is being recorded. So nobody has a problem with being on, or if you do, just be aware that this will be archived for the web, which we hope is forever. But please feel free to add your notes or comments or links to your own projects that you'd like us or other people here or not here to learn more about. What we would like to ask you to do is up on the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a link to log in, create account. Just to create an account, it takes a second. That way you can log in and add your notes to the page. So what we're finding is the more people use it, the better a resource it is for everybody here at the conference, everybody not here at the conference, for next year's planning, for next year's conference. It would be helpful. So we really want this to be as rich of a resource as possible for all of you. All right. So with that, I will turn it over to our moderator, Camilla Kovacs from the Media Access Project. She will... you can talk a little bit more about yourself and what you do at the Media Access Project, and we'll introduce our speakers. So, come on. Thank you.
Hey, all. Welcome to Citizen Journalism and Social Media, creating hyperlocal journalism in diverse community. As Tom pointed out, my name is Camilla Kovacs. I'm Development and Communications Director at Media Access Project. Media Access Project actually is a nonprofit public interest law firm and advocacy group in Washington, D.C. So basically what we do is we sort of represent both inside the Beltway and outside the Beltway organizations. And sure, if you want.
I can't hear you real good.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. In actual filings and petitions at the Federal Communications Commission on the Hill. And so we've been more of the inside the Beltway lawyering. I obviously fundraise and do press and everything else except for law. So that's about me. But we are sort of getting started here talking about specific projects around the country that really affect diverse and underrepresented communities in terms of journalism. And we have three really interesting projects that are either getting started or like have been on the ground for a long time here. We have Antoine Haywood. He's with People TV. He's the director of community and development over there. Murali Balaji is working together with me a little bit, actually, on Voice of Philadelphia. He's a co-founder of and executive director of Online Newsroom, as well as assistant professor at Lincoln University. And we have Ron Cooper, executive director of Access Sacramento. These are all three sort of on-the-ground, hyper-local journalism outlets of either public access, cable access, television, or in Morley's case, an online newsroom function that may or may not expand sort of beyond that. But without sort of further ado, I want to introduce all three of them and sort of let you guys talk a little bit more about your projects, how they actually affect communities on the ground. If you have any specific examples about the way your projects have touched the communities that you work with, and yes, sort of expand a little bit more about how you think hyper-local journalism can actually impact communities. So do you want
cool.
to start?
I can. All right. Good morning, everyone. How's everybody feeling? All good? Okay. Camilla said, my name is Antoine Haywood. I'm the director of community development, People TV, in Atlanta, GA. And People TV is the public access, the only public access, channel that's really active in within the city of Atlanta. And my job primarily is to build connections and help build community through the media. So connecting our organization with doing through outreach. To working with youth, also working with other community groups such as nonprofit organizations, civic associations, community development authorities, and the like. We do this in many ways. We produce public service announcements for nonprofits, like you know many centers do. We have our after-school youth program where we actually get into some forms of, I guess, what could be considered journalism reporting in both in the studio and in the field. And 3 years ago, we came up with a very unique project that was inspired by a long-standing project in Philadelphia called Precious Places. And I actually had a chance to experience that when I attended NAMAC back in 2005 or so, I believe. And you know, one thing I noticed about Philadelphia is there's a lot of neighborhood pride and there's a lot of neighborhood identity. And you know, just going through that tour, I was like, you know what? Atlanta has a lot of neighborhoods. That's why I rock my shirt today. You know, I live on the east side of town. Technically, I live in Reynolds Town, but I spend a lot of time and a lot of money and a lot of love and care in the EAV, East Atlanta Village. So I said, you know, wow, you know, we have these distinct neighborhoods that have these like very distinct identities in Atlanta, and that has a lot of history and stories that you don't see on, you know, in mainstream media, of course. You know, we're not seeing it on CNN unless somebody, you know, blew something up down there, the train fell off the track, and there's a hazard or something, you know. And then, of course, the local affiliates are, you know, they're in these neighborhoods, but it's always, you know, somebody got shot or, you know, it's very unfortunate news to hear. And one, I don't know if a lot of you experience this in the work that you do, you know, those of you especially as media makers and who run centers, you know, come across people that say, you know, why don't you produce some positive news? There needs to be some good stories, you know, I want to feel good. And so with Sidewalk Stories, we said, yeah, you know, we can definitely focus on and use our tools that we have and the knowledge and experience to connect with community organizations to help tell their stories the way that they want them to be told. So, yeah, there's some challenges that are there, you know, and but ultimately the key thing with Sidewalk Stories is there's a lot of hope. So some of the key project goals with Sidewalk Stories is, you know, we wanted to engage community groups in the documentary storytelling process, educate audiences about local history, community development initiatives that are going on throughout. And it's not just a city project, it's actually countywide. So it's Fulton County. And a lot of people have there's visions and strivings for community growth. That's what, you know, we want to help them to get across. And also introduce groups to the benefit of access and community-based media as a means to share stories that are important to their lives. So the key thing, you know, is this kind of, it's in-reach and outreach that's happening because we work with groups and they come to our facilities where we kind of, we do the training and then the planning and a lot of the pre-production kind of aspect in getting a feel. And then we go out into the communities and we make those connections. And then there's this encouragement of, you know, look, this is what's possible. You know, this is what you can do if you use community-based media. So the overall project process, a lot of people, you know, ask me about this. Well, how does the whole thing work? And, you know, Sidewalk Stories uniquely, we just focus on five communities. It could be community centers or their neighborhoods. And we put, each group gets about 10 to 12 minutes for their story, and we put it all together, and it makes, you can watch it as one complete documentary, or you can watch each individual one. And so the nice thing with that is they stand alone, and you have a lot of groups that say, you know, we want to use this for our website, we want to use this for future, you know, they have all these ideas for future purposes. So that seems to be, you know, the very attractive feature for this project. So we recruit volunteers and community groups in the start. It's an 8-month process that we go through. And we send out, you know, so we start, like, I want to say September, around that time, a little bit, you know, in the fall. And we really hit the ground running, like, in November. So we send out emails. We send out hard copies. You know, we talk to people, you know, via phone. We use various methods to get in contact with all of the communities because we get, through our surveys from doing this project, we get feedback of, you guys should try this neighborhood, or what about these people, you know, or how about this, you ever considered this? So we'll do our best to try to get in contact with those folks. But, you know, the reality of this is that, and you know, that I've learned, not everybody wants to be, is eager to be involved, you know? And it's kind of, that was a strange thing to get my head around, because we were like, you know, doesn't everybody want their story told? Doesn't everybody want to do, this is cool, you can get a camera and, you know, do your thing, edit and all this, and have screenings, and you're on TV. But there are some people that are very intimidated by the fact that they have to produce, even though we're there as staff to help support. That they're intimidated by the technology. And then also the biggest thing, though, is the time commitment. That's the largest thing. And, you know, and for everybody, you know, here that is media makers, you know the level of time that it takes to create a project, just to put together a cohesive and, you know, coherent 10 to 12 minutes that tells a story. but we get a lot of people that are very eager, and we recruit them, and they come on board. We conduct an introduction meeting. We found that works really well. We have all of the groups that are participating. You know, the groups, they fill out. We have a form, like a 3-page form that they submit, and it's an application. And myself and the associate producer Shannon, we pretty much review and we talk about kind of which neighborhoods we, you know, decide we can work with. And we also can get, like, we've gotten to the point now where we can anticipate, like, the level of commitment that we would get from these groups, because they submit, you know, some groups will submit, like, this thorough breakdown of, like, this is what I want to do. And you're like, okay, yeah, they're going to show up, you know. But then if you get somebody that just kind of scribbles something and it comes in, like, a week later, you're like, man, I don't know, you know. So it's like we need to get them on the phone and, like, have a dialogue and really kind of fill them out. So that's a lot of what I do as executive producer in the project, to really kind of gauge a sense of, like, will they really be engaged in this project? Because it is a major commitment. Like I said, it's 8 months. So we conduct the introduction meeting and pretty much lay everything out on the table and talk about, you know, here's what the goals, the objectives are. The next step, we host mini training sessions. So we do, you know, we put the camera in their hands. We let them work with the mics and setting it up, you know, how to do basic interviews in the field and, you know, in indoor settings. And we consult them through the script development process. This is always kind of tricky. We're still working on what, you know, finding the best methods for this. Some people are very good on their own of coming up with, you know, just crafting their stories that they want to tell. Some people just kind of, again, because of the time commitment that it's involved, they kind of got get lost. And so we find the best ways, like, you know, we have to check in with people to really make sure that they're, you know, are you okay? You know, you got your draft. Let's work on the next draft. You want to come in, we can talk about ideas, put it on the board, you know, map it all out. And some groups, you really, they need that time, you know. Some groups work very well with, you know, actually having FaceTime, where they have to come into our facility in our conference room, and we have to just do a map on the board, you know. So once they get introduced to using the tools, when you do the consulting and the script development, they get their scripts ready, then they start scheduling their shoots, and they do interviews out in the community. And this can take anywhere. Some groups have gotten it knocked out in 2 weeks. Some it takes an entire month for them. By the time of the process, when we're usually shooting B-roll and interviews right around the beginning of spring. So when things are, the trees are starting to blossom and everything in the city, we get to rolling. You know, so it's about like March, about April. Pretty much all the month of April is like shooting and just doing interviews. Some start a little bit in March. The other thing we found is that a lot of organizations, community groups, they have events that take place throughout the year that they want to include in their stories. You know, so they're like, well, you know, we're doing this with the kids. It's a neighborhood community cleanup. There's this, and so those become kind of pivotal, you know, targets for our production schedule. Once we get everything shot and done, then we get into the post-production and final review sessions. Pretty much because of, you know, we don't require the groups, we don't do extensive training and editing with them. The editing pretty much falls on us because we're on such a time. Like, all the month of May is editing, is post-production for the most part, because, you know, the thing has to be done in June and screened in June, early June, because guess what? The grant cycle ends on June 30th. So all of my project work has to be, so that's how I get that timetable. You know, and the groups are pretty, that's one good thing is, like, groups, in terms of, you know, the one kind of, like, it's journalistic aspect of this is, like, we do have a timeline, and there are deadlines that we set. We don't hit them all the time, you know, and we have the luxury because we're not like, we got to get this on the air by 5 p.m. Next week. But, you know, there is that, okay, the final premiere screening is June 11th. You know, we need to be done, you know, everything wrapped up, you know, the week before. So everybody's able to handle themselves accordingly. But yeah, so the post-production process is really unique. Some people, they actually are curious, they want to get some hands-on with Final Cut. You know, that's what we edit on. So we're on Final Cut Pro, and then they come in and, you know, they'll start, like, putting together a rough cut of their story. Some people, they don't want to touch it. They just want to sit there and, like, you know, direct us as we do it. And so we can just, you know, click, 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 and go through real quick. Yeah?
How many projects you got in the air at one time?
How many
projects do you have in the air at one time?
At one time? Oh, we just do 5 each, like, each group, like, each project. So there's, like, 5 stories on. So I'm handling 5 groups.
At once? They all start?
Yeah, this is all. Everybody starts at once. They move at different levels. Sometimes you got to crack the whip on some. You know, it's like, uh-oh, you know, Ron disappeared. Like, he's not answering his phone. He's not answering messages. Not Ron, but we had Ron. There's a Ron this year. And it's like, Ron, what's going on? You know, I know you got, like, 6 dogs, but, you know, we gotta do this project. You know, what's happening with your story? So, you know, and people are good for the most part. But, yeah, it's a lot that you do have to manage. And it's just 2 of us. It's myself and it's associate producer. And so we're, you know, even though it's 5 groups, like Precious Places has way more stories that are being told. But, you know, that thing, this is, you know, it's a little different, you know, in the way that we're, like, working with the groups in the process. Yeah.
Are you with them when they're shooting?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Yep.
Because...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We have to be, again, because that's an
eye. Ross and Eddie are in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're with them every step of the way. And we let them, that's laid out in the beginning. It's because there is, like I said before, there is intimidation in this, you know, especially with people that don't, you know, that do not have any experience at all. They love the concept, but they're just like, I don't know how to do this. That's why we're coming to you, you know. And that's the beauty of, that's the one of the advantages, the values that we have as community media professionals and centers is that that people come to us because they rely on, like, you guys know how to tell these stories. So, yeah.
And after they complete a project, are they then producing content on their own or do they come back and do it again? I mean, I know it's not for a long period of time, but you have some sort of follow-up?
Yeah, there's you know, some people do want to reproduce, you know, they continue to produce and they want to. In fact, I got a guy I need to call back. He called me last week. That was in this year's project. Like, they want to take classes because they want to create their own, they want to build up their own team. You know, they call it the filmmakers of English Avenue, you know. And so they've got that whole thing going and they want to get trained and they want to do something like every, you know, like a bi-weekly program that just focuses on English Avenue. But it's up to that community, you know. Like, we can't. I mean, I wish we could. We try to work with them as much as possible. But, you know, after that, we kind of like, well, we have to help you guys become self-sustainable, you know. Let me just get through the rest of this so I can give everybody time. We do so in the post-production. Mostly, we have folks come in and they give guidance to how they want their stories told. So they're involved in every step of the process, and I think that's a very key thing. There's that citizen engagement, you know, throughout. It's not us going into the communities and sticking cameras in people's faces and then leaving. That's what we tell them. And, you know, we have to explain that a lot when we're just, you know, walking around the communities, because a lot of people, you know, they think we're like the cops or something, you know, and just, and it's really interesting to see the impact of, like, when you break a camera out in a neighborhood, and particularly, you know, a low-income neighborhood. You know, there's a lot of, like, what are you doing, you know? So you really have to build up the relationships with the people in that community and build up trust and really can be able to articulate, you know, what the project is about and that this is about telling your story and helping get some more resources into this community. Let's go down.
Cool.
Yep, I'm about done. I'm done, yeah. Like I said, I did want to show a few clips. So I kind of, you know, went through some of these and answered your questions. You know, the communities, you know, I think Colin had asked me one big question of, you know, why do people want to get engaged? And, you know, for the common points that I could think of, you know, they're looking for new ways to tell their stories. You know, they want their stories to be told. There's a need to connect with a broader audience. There's also a curiosity in this whole, like, you know, what is this production thing? What is this? How do we create, you know, video and TV and media? But they're not sure on the technical, the ins and outs. And so that's what we're there for, you know, provide the knowledge. And then they're looking for new ways to get their residents involved in community activities, volunteers. So this, you know, working with media and doing a DVD and having a screening at the church or, you know, at the local rec center, and then doing it on an ongoing basis and putting it online with the neighborhood association website, like, that's a whole new, like, hot thing. You know, it's not just... So for them, it's like, well, the neighborhood association isn't just sitting in a room and bickering for 2.5 hours about, you know, Miss Jones, you know, has got trash on the lawn. You know, it's like, no, we're trying to do things with media, you know. So that's really worked out well for them. And like I said, we've got groups that are coming that want to continue to take classes, you know, and some actually have.
Do the stories vary? I mean, do they, for the most part, talk about their neighborhoods, or do they tackle issues within the neighborhood?
Yeah, they tackle issues. It's up to that neighborhood, you know. Some kind of stay away from it. It's kind of like who produces it. And then we had a conversation about this last night. Typically, like, community development corporations, they kind of have this overview, and it's not, they don't really get into kind of like tough issues of, you know, like really like poverty or, you know, drugs in the neighborhood, you know, those kinds of things. But then you have some people down on the ground that are like, yeah, we need to talk about this, and we need to give this exposure. You know, yes, this is a reality. I mean, English Avenue, and I think I'm going to, or actually, I might show a little bit of, I'm torn. But, you know, English Avenue, which is in this year, you know, it's in a prime location. It's near Midtown. It's near the Georgia Dome, where, you know, where the Falcons play. And it's right near downtown Atlanta, but you never know it's there. And it's kind of like cut off by this main thoroughfare, Northside Drive. So, and it's one of those neighborhoods, if you make that wrong turn, you know, you can get kind of lost back up in there. But it was, the interesting thing is, it was a flourishing neighborhood in the 50s and the 60s. And that story, people don't know that story, because it's been so, their story's been, you know, overshadowed by the influx of drugs that happened in the 80s, you know, starting in the 70s and the 80s. So now it's totally going through this whole revitalization, and the community is taking their community back, you know, some of the older residents. Yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed happening a lot around the country is youth urban design programs that are popping up all over the place. Does your agency work in any way with groups like that?
Urban design?
Youth urban design.
No, we don't.
It's happening all over the country. Yeah. And the documentation that you make is all about that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We talked a little bit with Georgia Tech about a project that they have. They're doing some mapping with tech students.
Exactly.
That ties kind of into this, you know. But they're still figuring out what they're doing, though.
Well, but one of the opportunities that community media agencies have is to create the authoritative narrative of their places.
Mm-hmm.
Working with people who are doing mapping and environmental testing, all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great opportunity.
Folks, if you don't mind saving your questions until after the folks finish. Yeah, and then we'll definitely get to them, but just make sure we answer them. Thanks.
Probably like 10 seconds today.
Yeah.
Okay. This is just so you can kind of see, we got permission from Google Maps this year. Fortunately, we don't have sound, but I just kind of want you to just kind of, you can get a seat for when we have this, came out with this year.
Hi, I'm Pat Joyner, the general manager of the Sweet Auburn Curve Market. The Sweet Auburn Curve Market is located at 209 Edgewood Avenue, on the corner of Jesse Hill and Edgewood, one block from Piedmont Avenue and the 7585 connector.
I'm still impressed now. The food is good. It's a clean environment.
All right. Yeah, if you want to check out more, we got links on YouTube. We don't have much time. And then our DVDs, of course, I brought them. We have the trilogy now. I'm so excited about this. Yeah, I got all. They're all three now. We have DVDs. If you want to go to our website and there's order forms, there's a link to the PDF, peopletv.org /sidewalkstories, and you can check that out. And the small clips are on YouTube. So I'll take questions, some more questions later. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Introducing Morley Balaji. He's executive director of Voice of Philadelphia online newsroom operation working out of Philadelphia. And also just to remind you all, if you don't mind saving your questions until after all of us are done here, we'll get to them for sure. And just to let you know, in terms of format, we did sort of try to plan to get one more question internally from the panel to sort of talk about. If we don't have time, fine, but thank you, Morley.
Thanks, man. Yeah. I don't have as technologically sophisticated of a presentation as Antoine, so I'll try to just breeze through this. Thanks again for having me. This is my first Alliance for Community Media conference, and I'm really excited by all the passion from people attending the conference. I think there are better days ahead, even in tough economic times. Let me just give you guys a brief history of how and why Voice of Philadelphia began. I was a journalist for almost 10 years, working for what was formerly known as Night Glitter, it doesn't exist anymore, and Gannett, as well as the Washington Post. And then I transitioned to academia, got my PhD, became a professor. And one of my close friends, Latrell Crittenden, who's now just completing his PhD at the University of Illinois, he came over one day and said, "We need to do something to change media." And I said, "Okay, dude, slow down." But Latrell was very frustrated because, like me, he's a former Gannett reporter, and he saw how mainstream media organizations, corporate-run newsrooms, segmented populations, and usually only covered underrepresented communities when something bad was happening, or when they needed a quote-unquote diverse stories. And this is not a lie. Gannett actually counts the number of diverse stories they do as part of their annual review. And if a manager gets more diverse stories, quote-unquote diverse stories, he or she gets a bonus. And so Latrell and I realized that we needed to do something. And both of us have strong ties to Philly from the area. And Latrell is, went to Lincoln University for the first few years of his undergrad. So he really got to see, some of the things that were taking place in the city up close. And we knew that there were a lot of these hyper-local startups, beginning in the mid to late 2000s. So we asked ourselves, what can we do to differentiate ourselves? And basically the problem we had identified is that communities of color, particularly low-income, working-class communities in neighborhoods outside of Center City, particularly South, Southwest, and West Philly, we're not getting their issues covered. That whenever, like the Philadelphia Inquirer, Daily News would cover their stories, they would basically parachute in and do one feature story or one, 10-inch column piece for the metro section and then parachute out. And it was the same for TV stations. One of the things that we wanted to do was have a community-generated journalism model that also adhered to high-quality copy. Let's face it, all of us read community news sites. All of us are part of community news sites. But sometimes the editorial content of a community-generated journalism site is not there. And a lot of times, readers lose interest. If there are a lot of editorial mistakes, if they're just poorly written, people are going to tune out. And so we wanted to make sure that we produced high-quality stories generated from the community, from the communities we cover. So this is really why we exist. We seek to give voice to people who don't have voice or regular access to media channels. We also focus on another aspect, and this is, you know, something Antoine has already touched on. I know most of you in this audience are doing your own channels as well. We're doing the citizen journalism training aspect, but we're doing it in a way, again, not only for people to be able to tell their stories, but to do it in a way that really does, you know, go toe-to-toe with other established journalism sites in Philly. So that people can't just say, oh, this is just a, you know, community start. So that's our two-pronged approach. Now, I wanted to give you guys a quick feel of who we are by going to the site. So a lot of the issues we cover, all of the issues we cover are neighborhood generated. So if there's something specific to West Philly, Southwest Philly, very rarely do we try to paint the city in a broad brush because, again, as Antoine's presentation showed, there are many diverse neighborhoods in the city. And the last thing we want to do is, you know, make Philadelphia into a homogenous whole. Since we launched a couple months, we're kind of the baby among the, I know Ron's, you know, had Access Sacramento for 25 years. You know, we've existed for a few months. But we focus on several key issues. Education, immigration, there's a huge new American population in the city. Social and media justice. And one of the things that we're trying to do, and we've had mixed success, is really reach out to other community media organizations. We don't believe that community media organizations should really be openly competing with each other. We think that now is the time, especially in a bad economy, to focus more on content collaboration, you know, programming collaboration. So we have formed partnerships with the Philadelphia Public School Notebook, the Media Mobilizing Project, the Scribe Video Center, which has been an institution in this, in West Philly for years, and the one of the big players, the PBS station, WHYY. And the reason why we are so active in forming these partnerships is, quite frankly, we don't have the resources to cover everything. And secondly, we have to acknowledge the fact that we're not experts on some of the issues that we're seeking to cover. You know, the Philadelphia Public School Notebook has existed for almost 10 years, and they're doing great stuff on Philadelphia schools. That's why we're partnering with them. So we update the site daily. We want to give it, you know, we want to present it to our readers that every day they will read new stories when they come on the site. We are also incorporating audio and video into the site. And hopefully by the fall, Voice of Philly website will be redesigned so that, you know, it's not just a WordPress site. Here's our staff, all volunteer. I'm the executive director. Latrell is the executive editor and publisher. And because I'm a professor at Lincoln, my students are serving as interns. And they're all from the neighborhoods we cover. So they know what's going on. They go to the community meetings. They have their neighbors telling them what's going on. So we have our eyes and ears, again, in the communities we cover. Within the next couple of years, we're envisioning becoming one of the most visible and viable community journalism organizations. And it's a step-by-step process. A lot of journalism startups have the vision in terms of the content, but they don't realize the uphill climb when it comes to infrastructure. We're doing infrastructure and content on parallel tracks. You know, it's great to have an online newsroom, but if you don't have a fundraising mechanism, if you don't have any understanding of how to operate a nonprofit, you're not going to last. You know, our goal, again, as I said, is to encourage citizen journalism, but to do it in a high-quality way. And that really does take, as Antoine mentioned, it takes a lot of patience, and it does take a lot of, hey, look, I know you wanted to write this story X, but can I show you how to do it Y? I'll really quickly go over our challenges. Pretty much consistent with, I think, a lot of ACN members, but fundraising. You know, in this day and age, we have to be creative in how we raise money. We're starting a membership drive within the next couple of months. Online donations are going to be huge. We know that we have our audience and the communities we cover, but we also have people who are into progressive causes who are more willing to do their online donations. So we have snail mail and we have PayPal. The other thing, too, is it's great to have a vision. Some of you have been around your organization since the beginning. That's great. But it's about how to keep, how to hire people who are able to sustain the organization. And one of the challenges for us is going to be hiring people who are going to be able to grow the organization. We also have to develop content that keeps our readers interested. You know, we can't just keep writing the same stories. And that is going to be a challenge. The other thing, too, is this: Philadelphia is funny because there are so many nonprofits. They all generally compete with one another. And it is a lot to do with the fact that Philly is a very segregated city, from neighborhood, block to block. And we have to do our job to distinguish ourselves from other community journalism sites that will inevitably launch in the near future. Why are we unique, and why are we important, and why should you care about us? And that is going to be a challenge for us. And the last thing is, we have a fiscal sponsorship now through Resources for Human Development, which is one of the largest nonprofit incubators in the country. And they are helping us administratively. But we realize in the next 4 to 5 years, to become our own 501c3, that, you know, we're going to have to do a lot in terms of administrative rebuilding. So, again, this is more of like a very snippet view of our organization. I wanted to go through it as quickly as I could so that I gave some time for Ron and obviously for you guys to be able to ask questions after we present. But, again, we are the baby of this panel, but we do envision being around for a long time to come. And I thank you all for your time.
Thanks, Morley. Finally, I want to introduce Ron Cooper, Executive Director of Access Sacramento.
Access Sacramento has been around for a while, since 1987, and what we're about is 25 years of traditional public access serving all of Sacramento County, about 250,000 cable subscribers. There's separate entities serving public education and government access. For most of those 25 years, it's been a competitive type of environment. I don't know about what you do in the morning when you read the news, but in California, it's crisis after crisis after crisis. Los Angeles public access has disappeared. San Francisco is drastically reduced. Tucson is drastically reduced. Reno, just last week, has disappeared. So in Sacramento County, it's not just at the state level with the capital there, but it's parole officers are essentially gone from the sheriff's department. Protective services cut in half. So the reason why I mentioned this, we were talking a little bit about this, I think Satchel Paige has said, you know, don't slow down and look behind you because you're probably catching up. You know, it's you've got to keep moving. You've got to keep on your toes. So part of the process here with the PEG access movement, and particularly public access, I think, is really understanding that our resources that are derived from cable franchising process, that the funding that the 5% franchise fee in California and many other states has always been in dispute, always in competition with all of these other budget problems. And the key motivating factor, I think, for our organization and for me personally is the days of money coming from the franchise fee in any significant amount never were that great. Right now in Sacramento County, they collect $12.2 million in franchise fees, and for all the PEG access operations, it's about $1.2 million. The rest of it goes to the general fund. We get about $400,000. And we do a lot with that, and there's always the expectation of doing more. So this is what more looks like. So about a year ago, in fact, it was at this conference that the pre-conference kind of did a summary of where we were with our fascination, as many of you, with the Knight Foundation and their generosity and trying to come up with new ideas. Presented a year ago, so it's been a year from that conference in Portland to this, of establishing what we refer to as neighborhood news bureaus. And so I'm going to walk very quickly through. There's a green handout in the back. There's plenty for everybody, I think. So that outlines the process. But the idea here is to repurpose our public access resources to continue the process of training volunteers, but now to incorporate more actively and directly trusted community-based organizations, particularly in South Sacramento, which is, we have many areas of great diversity. Sacramento in 2004 was named by Time Magazine as one of the most successfully diverse city in the, nobody quite understands how they evaluated that, but it got, you know, notoriety, and we're quite proud of our diversity. But as in many of your communities, the issue of diversity is a given. California, I mean, we're the poster child for diversity. In our school district, Sacramento City Schools teaches and engages 80 different languages on a daily basis. In Los Angeles County Schools, it's 120 languages. So the issue of, gee, how about everybody that doesn't speak English go home? I mean, we all know that, but the reality of coming to grips with that is the challenge of the 21st century. But technology offers a way to address this, and this is what we're trying to do. The other critical factor is youth. And as you'll see in the paper that I've written there, our fascination, and this goes back several years now, but, you know, can we get Timmy in here to fix the VCR? And there's something wrong here. I don't know what that. I mean, that's been going on for 20 years. But meanwhile, in that generation, the millennials, the net natives, however you want to call, I'm a big proponent of understanding the generations, the four distinct generations at play in the workforce and in our homes and communities. So we want to capitalize on the fact that young people have had access to technology from birth, that there is a knowledge base that's resident there in young people, and that we really haven't tapped into that. I don't think we've, as my generation, I don't think we've really invited that. Not those kids, they just waste their time. And as we say, you know, what about if we aggregated all those digital tweets and videos and photos? We needed a more robust website than we currently have, so we've developed accesslocal.tv. And then use our current resources to develop that and to market that. One of the conversations that we had in preparing for the conference was this concept of citizen journalism, and I've always asked the question, who came up with that idea? I suspect it was a journalist who was cynical and wanted to really, from the beginning, put a challenge out there that's really unrealistic, and that is citizen journalists are not going to go in and, you know, track Schwarzenegger down over a 9-month period and expose, you know, corruption at the highest level of the mayor's office, and journalists have a right to say, you know, my training, my background, you're suggesting that anybody can do my job, and it puts off immediately what can be, as we hope, one of your leading proponents and allies, if you don't insult them by saying, yeah, anybody can do your job. So our plan is to, and has been so far, to partner with professional journalists. And then 60-40, you'll hear me talking about that a lot. A lot of what's being done on the internet now addresses the 60% who love it, in varying degrees. But there's a 40% of the population that's been persistent over the last 40 years, 30%, 35%, whatever, but about 60-40 that don't play. And there's a variety of reasons. Can't afford it, don't know how, could care about technology. I think my mom, who's 82, it's about typing. I don't type, therefore I don't want to do that. But there's all kinds of reasons why. But basically, it's an untapped market, if you want to look at it that way. But it's also very high in the issue that we're discussing today, and that is diverse communities, non-English speaking communities, poorer communities, the issue of the internet. There's a high percentage of non-users in diverse communities. Why bureaus find, as we've already talked about in this track and today, the downsizing of local media has created an opportunity. It's chaos for them. The Sacramento Bee has laid off a third of their reporters. But it opened an opportunity for them to put our blog on zachbee.com. We've been knocking on the door of the Bee for 25 years. Maybe there's something going on here. Maybe there's an opportunity. Cell phone technology. This is amazing what's going on. As my son says, you know, my computer in my pocket. Now it's my TV studio in my pocket. I just saw an iPhone HD shot and edited movie. That was just extraordinary. Shot on the latest version of iPhone and edited on iPhone. There's also an opportunity for revenue, for all kinds of new opportunities. I'm suspecting 2 or 3 years from now, we will have really looked at online revenue generation in new and exciting ways. But as you'll see as we go on here, I think there's lots of opportunities there. And as I mentioned before, the real critical factor of inclusion. We aren't creating neighborhood news bureaus just to generically, right from the get-go, serve everybody in Sacramento County. I live in South Sacramento County. I am the minority in my community. And I'm sick and tired of this media dump. Oh, tragedy in South Sacramento. We lead our news tonight with another failure. And it's just so not reflective. It's insulting and it's racist. But that's one thing to say, and it's another thing to say, no, let's do something about it. And if you have stories that are about the positive things going on in your community, about jobs, about schools, about what young people are doing and so forth, then who's better to prepare that, who's better to offer that than you and your community? So the idea is to go directly into South Sac and identify partners. And we know who these folks are because we've been working for 25 years. And again, now I'm speaking to the public access folks, because in these previous citizen journalism track workshops, I've heard kind of a theme of, yeah, public access, Ron, we've got plenty on the plate, we don't have resources. I'm telling you, if you don't move somehow in this direction, you're going to have even less resources, okay? I'm just absolutely convinced that this makes us relevant in the future. And that you just have to figure a way to look at your existing resources and build upon your history. This isn't new and different and alien, oh my God. Just as Antoine was saying, this is absolutely consistent. His program is absolutely of the public access model, but moving directly in terms of working with neighborhoods to create journalism. So we have an existing infrastructure. We've developed over the, especially the last couple of years with Sacramento Bee, Comcast posts about 50 of our series online on their on-demand. Sacramento Press was here. That's an online for-profit newspaper that is written primarily by trained volunteers, and we're working with them. We're entrusted, at least 50% of our programming produced locally is done by people of color. We, with the Knight Foundation proposal, got all kinds of wonderful letters of support. We're modeled in some ways after the Rapidian and Laurie Cervello in Grand Rapids, Michigan, but learning from everybody here at the conference as well. And again, accesslocal.tv. And if you go, if you're online now, if you go to accesslocal.tv, it's just a vanilla page, but if you click on the Neighborhood News Bureau logo, you'll see what I guess is referred to as the alpha site, because we're not showing it publicly, but I wanted to make the case that it's not building the website. The website's there. Now we're going to populate it. We're going to, again, this process of going forward, of training reporters, introducing relevant information. A Pew study found that in that 40%, there are many reasons, as I mentioned, and we can all think of several, why the 40% isn't using the internet to their disadvantage. The bus is leaving them, and that's a tragedy. That's not democracy. That's a 60-40 split that we have to do everything we can to address. But the Pew study found that the central theme of the 40% non-users was relevance. I don't get it. Why should I learn the skills? Why should I pay the money? Whatever. If it was relevant to my daily life, then maybe I'd be more interested. So this has to be relevant, and we're proposing that we create stories in order to of a neighborhood nature that would be relevant. We're designing the website on a WordPress multi-user aggregated blog site. Okay, memorize that. But the idea is it's going to train folks and provide them with the absolute lowest threshold of loading any kind of digital content whatsoever onto their distinct blog site. In the beginning, new content will be developed, read by professional journalists who will develop leads, followed up by professional journalists for their own publications. Attractive then because of the stickiness factor of constant news for Google Ads and other online opportunities, and bilingual English Spanish from the beginning. These are our five partner agencies, all trusted organizations, but each also the capstone of a much larger network. Asian Resource Center, obviously, La Familia, obviously, NPO's impeccable records of training and just working so hard in their communities. The Meadowview Pinnell Community Center is the heart of the African American community, and it's a beautiful 12-acre pool, a wonderful facility. It's Sacramento City Parks and Rec. Florin Creek is Southgate Parks and Rec. And Valley High Library is the newest, most technologically advanced of the 27 library system in the county. So just kind of walking through what we're doing, and when I get back on Wednesday, we're having our first meeting of the five families, the five organizations, in order to have the face-to-face of moving forward. Our marketing strength with our partners, the local media, who don't, you know, or aren't upset about this, they like the idea. And you'll hear me talking about the tipping point and Malcolm Gladwell's book. It's a great book to read. And he talks about connectors, mavens, and salespeople. That the 80% of the world sits around waiting for the 20% to do something. And the 20% are made up of connectors, mavens, and salespeople. Think of connectors as youth. Think of mavens as old farts. And think of salespeople as AT&T, Comcast, everybody else who wants to crack the market. of the 40% who are not currently participating. We want to create a digital epidemic of stories and just capitalize particularly on youth and to help them look to their communities and provide leadership, and that we invite that leadership, we invite their participation, but to work together with others. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks again to the great panelists. Just one question to sort of bounce off of, and so you guys can sort of touch on this, and I wanted to get maybe the audience's opinions as well. What exactly is citizen journalism? What does that mean? When you say some of you actually train citizen journalists, when do you become a qualified citizen journalist? What's the training involved? You know, when am I actually a journalist or not a journalist? And perhaps even how do citizen journalists, and Ron touched on this a little bit, work together with the accredited, you know, mainstream commercial journalists, and how does that relationship sort of play out? How can we work for a better relationship in the future? So it's a broad question, but sort of what do you guys think?
Well, I'll take a quick stab at it. You know, when I entered the newspaper profession in the 90s, you know, there was still a lot of prestige associated with being a journalist, whether you were a broadcast or a print journalist. And obviously, this is pre-internet journalism. But, you know, in the last few years, when someone says, you know, I'm a journalist, you know, the second question someone will follow up after to say, what do you do? Say, well, are you on some sort of public assistance? Because obviously the professional journalist model, you know, seems to have gone down the food chain. So, you know, Ron might have hit on something as far as, you know, who came up with this idea of citizen journalism. I think a lot of people glorify like neighborhood bloggers or people who, you know, put out these newsletters as citizen journalists. And their contributions are valuable, but one of the things about the journalism profession is that, you know, there is a trust. There is a public integrity. That's why there are sites that are, say, opinion sites, and there are sites that really do thorough reporting. And Ron hit on this as well. Clearly, when we talk about the idea of journalists, are people from the community just going to be trained to start doing investigative pieces on City Hall or licensing inspections? No. But when I think of citizen journalists, I think of community members who are trained in the basic ethos of journalism. How do you get quotes? How do you maintain accuracy? How do you not just make stuff up? One of my interns, this is a journalism major at my university, she basically, quote unquote, borrowed a quote, you know, from another publication and pasted in her story. And fortunately, before we ran it, Latrell does all these quote checks on Google, and he makes sure that, you know, it's not reprinted. But Voice of Philly could have been shut down over a plagiarism thing if we hadn't edited. That's where we say, okay, citizen journalism. Okay, we are getting community members engaged, but we are also giving them the do's and don'ts of how to produce content. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, oh, hey, look, I got a story to tell. It's, there's a standard we sort of adhere to when we're producing content. That's the way I define it.
I guess that's interesting. One thing that we've experienced, because I sidewalk stories, I never really kind of envisioned as, or I'd classify it as a citizen journalism project, but I mean, if you really kind of look into it, yeah, it falls in there. But there's a lot that the participants learn about the editorial process. I mean, a great deal, because we're shooting hours and hours of footage of these interviews and like oral histories and just, you know, Jerome on the street and just, you know, it's all kinds of things. And it's like, what do you include? That's a funny story. Or what don't you include? Is what she was talking about, this person, you know, it may be an elder of the community, but, you know, is their memory, is that accurate, what they're talking about? So you have to kind of do some fact checking and, you know, a little bit of that, and then just but basically really narrowing it down to like, how do I tell a story in this time frame? You know, so whether, you know, you're dealing with print or a blog, you have a defined space. But for us in the documentary, they got that 10 to 12 minutes to fill.
Yeah. And I again, piggyback on this notion of, you know, those of us in public access, what have we been doing all these years? Don't we all believe in the premise that each individual, every human being on this planet is filled with stories?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the history of humankind storytelling, sharing stories? Isn't this just the latest version of technology that is exciting and extraordinary? Aren't tweets 140 character stories? Mm-hmm. Doesn't that lower the threshold of participation from all of the angst and anxiety? And, oh, you mean it's just typing 140 characters and I can be a player too? Mm-hmm. And so it's just opening up, I mean, and even the idea, and I absolutely agree in terms of as we go forward and as we train citizen reporters and the idea of integrity, the idea of truth, the idea of 100, just as with public access, you're 100% responsible, you are not anonymous, you have to be public, and so forth. All of these are critical. But I want to cite one example, and those who know me, oh God, he's going to talk his kids again. Okay, my son Joel is making it as a comedy writer in L.A., and he and 12 smart-ass friends of his started BP Global PR. Okay, it's they are the anonymous Terry, who was the 25-year-old BP. What could Terry do? Well, Terry does the Twitter. So they created this account that grew. BP had 7,000 tweet followers. Within 2 weeks, they had 100,000. It was picked up by. It was, who is Terry? What is this? Joel's was quoted in the time was, we wouldn't be having this problems if it was the Gulf of America. Arizona knows what I'm talking about. Now, why I share that is, you know, oh, so we're glad that Joel and his friends, as smart asses, can make a living. That's great. But what's really exciting about it is you talk to Joel and his friends, and they're going, yeah, but what happens when the evildoers do this kind of dastardly deed? And within a week, it's, where the hell was Obama? It's not about BP, but with this smart-ass humor using tweets and the media's, big media's churn to look and come up with stories, they keep coming back to smart-ass Terry and the arrogance of BP, and who is this, and what, and it should be focused on BP, and what are you doing? So what I'm saying is I'm really excited by where this is going, and I don't think we need to know exactly where it's going, but it's exciting, and there is no alternative, I think, but to jump in and start swimming in the Gulf, I guess, whatever.
Are you saying that there is the same editorial standard that you put on the Access TV side will be applied to this new venture as opposed to what this gentleman was, his aspiration for his?
Yeah. The thought that we have, which is different than, we're not cast, we look at the Rapidian, and the Rapidian in Grand Rapids cast the net and said, who'd like to be a reporter? Okay. We're not doing that. We're saying, one, to go into the diverse communities that we're talking about with all the challenges that I briefly outlined, let's go with partners. Let's identify partners and let's say you're going to be the blog master for your site, and you know your community best, and we're going to provide you with tools and technology and training. But what La Familia decides to do exactly, and to the degree that they want to empower folks and so forth, we'll work that out. What Asian Resources does, how the library uses this, we're going to work with those agencies in service to those communities that they're already trusted by. And then each of them has already presented themselves very differently. We have 5 distinct communities, 5 different styles of operation, all the way from a library and all the standards they have, all the way through to, oh my God, you know, we provide every service under the sun and need to do more. So we're going to experiment, we're going to find out, and then from those lessons eventually start, oh, you want a blog site too, and when you sign up for Access Sacramento, would you like a blog with that? You know, I mean, it's and the idea is eventually accesslocal.tv will have these neighborhood news bureau aggregator within the aggregated site, but they'll also be part of individual membership in Access Sacramento for those who want to pursue this. And then we'll kind of see it, hopefully, like a grass fire.
So this will not subsume your corporate site?
No.
These are two independent?
Well, I wouldn't say they're independent, but I think the style of, this is kind of our area of experimentation in terms of going forward. Where is this going to lead us? Where we have the grant from the Cable Commission, we have our duties 24/7 on the access channels. This doesn't interfere with that. And in fact, we expect this is going to encourage new fresh videos, new fresh programming that will run on the cable channels and complete the loop of why are we spending money on a website? Well, it creates content for the access. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
I have a pass at your definition. Which arises from the question, who generates the authoritative narrative of your place? And supposes that community media has the potential to establish the credibility to provide the authoritative narrative of your place. And I would suggest to anybody who's interested in citizen journalism that you Google citizen science, because there's a movement all around the country of citizen science, empowering citizens to use rigorous methodologies to document what's real, and then put it up there so people can see how the pattern of life is working.
Right.
And I think citizen journalism and citizen science can coincide in community media, and you can make the authoritative narrative of your place.
And I don't think Encyclopedia Britannica should be asked to comment on whether Wikipedia is a good idea.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I have, I guess it's becoming my usual question: money. You're getting funding from grants and from franchise fees, and you were talking about a for-profit news site in Sacramento, mm-hmm. and sort of you had a nice bullet point that said revenue, and then it said crowdsourcing or whatever. And I mean, the reason the newspapers are going under is because, they have a kind of crazy model, but they nobody wants to pay for it. Everyone thinks that they should get it for free. We all need to make a living. You
right.
guys are making your money from something else and doing that, but everybody can't do that. As you said, it's a huge time commitment. So how do you see in the long term the financial support coming from where?
Well, I guess the one piece that I, again, the theme of hearing from other panels and so forth, this is all based on my sitting down with others and writing a Knight News Foundation News Challenge grant that was not funded. We didn't get any Knight funding. But in writing that out, we had to go out and say, well, what do you think about this idea? What do you think about that? We got letters from university presidents, from Assemblywoman Doris Matsui, from the city council people. They all loved this idea. And we had no money. It was just Access Sacramento, due diligence in the community with a new idea. What do you think? And June 3rd, the Sacramento Metropolitan Cable Television Commission, with the dreaded DIVCA, which is California's version of the 22-state AT&T, you know, state cable franchising initiative. DIVCA allowed local governments to raise 1%, for the first time, 1% above the 5% franchise fee for dedicated paid capital funding only. So we applied saying, hey, you know, we've been talking about this. It's not building the website, but how about a lease-to-own server architecture that will handle all this digital media behind accesslocal.tv, and help us buy equipment for those community organizations that need computers and flip cameras and so forth. They bought it. And so they're funding for a two-year project going forward with this. So, and I'm not saying, and I think this is really important, our model probably wouldn't work 100% in your community. But your job is to look at what will work in my community and where are the alliances and allies and associations, and to not assume that local commercial media is antagonistic, as they have been for 25 years. Everything is changing. The rules are changing. And if you have the, excuse my language, if you have the balls to step up and say, damn it, we're going to take this on. And public access is perfectly positioned at every one of your communities to do that. Yeah. It's to just own that. But move forward and say, it's going to be messy, we don't have all the, but we've learned some things, we know some things.
Yeah, one thing that has worked in our community, and you know, Ron's absolutely right, and I've been, this is a reoccurring theme, is you have to, you know the culture of your environment, the culture of, you know, giving, the culture of partnerships. But the on the back here, the arts councils in our communities, this is how this project is funded. They're down with this, they love this, you know. They also love our youth program. That's like the big thing that, you know, we don't go to them and say, you know, we'll public access, fund us. They're not cool with that. But if you say, hey, we're doing this documentary project that engages the community, we're empowering youth, and you were teaching them technology and how to have a voice, and they're like, okay. So that's what's worked, you know, for us. The other opportunities that is growing out of Sidewalk Stories, I mentioned the involvement of, you know, you have your community development corporations, and the economic development, like community economic development associations, the people, Fairburn was in this, and we've continued to, we've already started doing some more work with Fairburn, and you know, we've got some plans of, Fairburn has a lot of big international corporations that have their warehouses down there, and they love being a part of that community, and they want to support it in any way, so they're like, yeah, well, having people in the community being able to talk about different issues and stay connected through media, you know, there's a huge potential.
And when you read this document, you'll see the word health a lot. Mm-hmm. It's because this is kind of the prototype document for the California Endowment, which is Blue Cross, $100 million over 10 years for the state of California when they went public to private. And so it's got to be about health, but they're saying, okay, how about $50,000 a year for the next 2 years? Out of the blue, based on, we think this is a replicable model, youth, UC Davis is our youth partner. There's so many themes to this, and that's what I hear you saying, Antoine, that you could start grant writing in 100 different directions in being bold in ways in which folks are just scared to death right now. Just be bold.
And I'll add one quick thing to both of what they said. When we talk about how do we do fundraising beyond the grants and beyond the member drives, it's going to take basically all of us to really put in the extra work to come up with innovative programming that people want to buy. One thing that LaShawla and I are working on is getting community centers, getting various nonprofits to pay us, you know, a nominal fee, which all goes to Voice of Philly, but we would do the citizen journalism training. It's at no cost to people who come and attend the event, but the organization that's hosting the event, you know, would give us some money to do the training. Now, is that going to get a lot? No, but one of the other things that we are aware of is that as we, I don't want to say run out, but as we exhaust all the channels of funding, we also know that we have to exist within our means, and we just have to at times be very conservative in you know, where we're investing the resources we have. So that's really what it comes down to.
I want to make a statement that's going to probably make me a very unpopular person, but I feel it needs to be said, because one of the things that I've noticed in this conference in the past 3 days that I've been here is the growing trend to how do I either make money out of public access or in public access or because of public access. When I got into public access over 20 years ago, it was as a volunteer. And you take something like a website, like Sacramento's book, I can see how a website like this on a WordPress platform, maybe not to the scale that they're doing, would cost an individual about $20 a month. Now, it's not going to be just one person doing this. And that's how when we started in Access, we worked as a team. So if you diversify the people working on a project like this, and you diversify the cost, you get a half a dozen people who are contributing articles, everybody can afford $2 a month. And if we're doing this out of necessity for our communities and out of interest in our communities, and an interest of serving our communities. Cost isn't really a factor. I can see where cost becomes a factor if you're trying to make a single person is trying to make a living off of these. But if we're truly interested in representing our communities, in going out and meeting with other neighborhoods, then cost isn't really a factor because one person can't do it alone, period. And you have to spread that out over a bunch of people. So if you're spreading the diversity of contributing to this over a bunch of people, $1 or $2 a month, even at something like Squarespace, which is probably one of the more premier web hosting sites, that's only $14 a month. So we have to look at why are we doing this? Are we doing this to try to make money for ourselves and keep ourselves in business, or are we trying to do it for the community? And if we're doing it for the community, it's not a difficult nor a financial challenge.
Well, what about the people that have to provide the education?
For
those people that may be doing, and I'm thinking in terms of, I'm not necessarily like a blog or anything, but I'm thinking in terms of like doing, even if it's like a just 2 minute videos on a regular basis, you know, who's going to teach that and who's going to kind of facilitate, you know, the project and make sure that, you know, everybody, if there's any questions, people need some technical assistance,
that's the purpose of the Access Center. And that's
right.
Why Access Center is, I'm looking more of the hyper-local blogging
okay.
type thing, because I've seen it in our community where, you know, folks have tried to start basically their own CNN on the web,
right.
Come out of the box really big, think they're going to make their life out of it.
Right.
And you're not going to go to CNN level overnight. But if you start off small, and if you're good at what you do, just like a commercial business, you will succeed. People will get behind you. Money, people will get behind you, and it'll progress.
So I have a question. Why did you think that statement was not going to be a popular statement? That seems to be exactly what we're all talking about, and what public access is about.
It is. The reason why I said it wouldn't be a popular statement is, in meeting with several different folks, it seems to be more of, you know, how can we get these large-scale grants to do hyper-local things?
Well, it's not about the large-scale grants. I mean, I think we're all very realistic that large-scale grants are not, you know, we're just not going to submit a grant. Like Ron was saying, they did this meticulous night news challenge proposal and they
didn't
get funded.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I would caution you to do is not to overgeneralize when it comes to different communities. I'll tell you right now, you're saying, oh, well, it's $2 a month, you know, people who are committed. You know, some of the communities, you know, we're covering, $2 a month for anyone is still $2 a month. They don't want to pay $2 a month. And it's not because they don't have $2. It's just the principle. It's like, I don't want to pay for this, even though it's a vital resource in my community, I don't feel like paying. And so, you know, I know what you're saying. I know we as community media organizations can't be money-driven, but we can't exist on ideals alone. We have to be aware that these grants, sometimes you get a grant that you think every year I'm going to submit, I'm going to get this grant renewed. And it doesn't happen. Sometimes foundations collapse. Sometimes, like for example, corporate foundations, when corporations merge, they go at least 2 years without accepting any new proposals. So the reality is we may have passionate members, but you know, in college, I remember starting up, you know, this club, and I asked, you know, everyone was really excited about it. It was a student journalists of color organization. People were like, oh yeah, this is great. I was like, okay, just $10 a month, you know, $10 for the entire year, guys. Oh man, I can't do that. You know, $10, you know, and that's like a cost of one pizza, right? But I'm telling you, we may think $2 a month is nothing, but I'm telling you, there are people in the communities we cover who don't want to pay a penny.
Just one other thought. One of the reasons why we're going with WordPress multi-user is each of those individual blogs will also have the capability. So blogs means Asian Resource Center. Asian Resource Center's blog will be able to sell advertising to all the small Asian community businesses that currently don't advertise online, don't advertise, period. And we're missing on all that wonderful food at those great restaurants and great shopping and all the rest because those communities just aren't talking to each other. So the idea is Asian Resources will be able to put advertising on their blog if they wish, to generate revenue from those businesses that support what they're doing, and Access Sacramento as the aggregator gets a taste of that. I mean, and I'm not saying that there is a model here that will work exactly for you, but we have to be about, as we've been advised by a very well-known nonprofit consultant, it's all about generating revenue, whether you're for-profit or nonprofit. It's what you do with the excess revenue that separates you. It's not that, oh, sorry, we made money. Let me apologize. No, it's a matter of generating revenue, but what you do with that revenue in service to the community and service to your mission.
And please trust me, I'm not because I think y'all have a great model, and I want to find out more about it. I don't want that money is a perceived barrier to doing this and to doing it well.
Right.
And all of you folks up there, I marvel at what y'all are doing. In fact, I'm going to try to model some stuff off what you guys are doing in Atlanta, because we're doing a similar thing that's not working so well, and you guys have really kind of fine-tuned it. And we're a fortunate access center, and the fact that we do have a lot of resources, and we do have a lot of things like that. But when folks from the community come to us and say, well, we just don't have any money, so we can't do anything, no, that's not true. You don't need a lot of money to do something. I want to make sure that part doesn't get lost.
Right.
You know, in the, especially...
But you need some money.
You need some money. Yeah. But what you need to get started is integrity. Absolutely. The integrity, the journalistic integrity.
Talk to Los... And again, talk to Los Angeles about integrity funding public access.
Yeah.
They killed public access because the financial model didn't work, and there's just no way the people of Los Angeles can revive it. Los Angeles is huge. San Francisco is huge. Diverse. All of the good things. But it doesn't just happen like mushrooms. You know, I mean, there have to be funding mechanisms, and going forward, we've got to be more clever, more nimble.
So I think we're unfortunately running out of time. We continue to discuss afterwards, you know, one-on-one. But before we close, I did want to point out, you'll see a kind of orange-ish red, if you guys want to hold up.
Oh, yeah, I got you.
Booklet right near next to you. There's not enough for everyone because it looks like we got a really good turnout here. But if you don't have one, I highly recommend you look online on the Knight Commission's website. So the Knight Foundation funded a study last year in 2009 by the Knight Commission to sort of look at how journalistic enterprises like public access, like or, you know, cable access, like online, can sort of move into a supportable digital sphere as everything's moving onto the internet. And they sort of looked at how communities even receive information, what are the information needs of communities. And so I highly recommend, based on the discussions we're talking about today, that y'all check it out. Essentially, just to sum it up, they looked at three areas: increasing availability of information, enhancing information capacity of individuals, such as training citizen journalists, and promoting public engagement. So it's a really good report. It sort of starts the dialogue out about this and moving into the future. But yeah, thanks so much for our great panelists today. Get up.
Don't forget your evaluations.
Oh, there was a question from the audience. Is everybody able to post their presentations online?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah,
I can,
absolutely.
Or to send me a copy, I can do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I can just give it to you right now.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah.
Can I put these in the photocam?
Yeah. Just, yeah, get a go. Get a, I forgot my order forms, but, you know, just... Order.